You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes.
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Welcome to Stories with Briscoe and Bradshaw. I would be Bradshaw. That would be the Oklahoma legend, the WWE Hall of Famer, Mr. Gerald Briscoe. And we've got a two-time Hall of Famer, the only person to go in successive years, an integral part of two of the greatest factions in wrestling history, a huge part of the Attitude Era on both sides. He was here, he was there, and then he was back. And he's one of the best guys in the business. He's a good friend of ours. Mr. Sean Waltman, X-Pac, thanks for joining us.
Oh, man, I've already told you a few times now how honored I am. And, you know, sitting back, feeling left out, watching you guys have it like Stan Hansen and Michael Hay, like all, you know. Anyways, man, it feels good to be in this company.
The best part of these shows is always trying to get a bunch of old wrestlers that are used to rotary dial phones on Zoom. So,
yeah. Sean, it has been so much fun doing this, you know, and when John and I first started, you know, we kind of exchanged lists. You were on our list, but, you know, we know your schedule and we know your what you've been doing with yourself, and we're so proud of you. But, you know, we figured we'd start in chronological order, yeah. You know, and start with the Stan Hansen, and he's 2,000 miles away from me, so I could call him an old fart. But I hope I don't have to do an autograph session with him here anytime coming up there. But, you know, we kind of started like that, but you were on both of our lists, so it's an honor, and, you know, and I'm just amazed that, you know, the kid that I met when he was about 16, 17, 18 years old, you know, back in the early days, what you've become. And, you know, man, you've done it all. But, you know, the trainers you've had, Carl Gotch.
Well, it was
Boris Malenko, and Eddie. And let's don't forget Eddie Sharkey, man, one of the greatest trainers in the world. Just tell us a little bit about that.
Well, so I would love for people to think that Carl actually trained me. It was more Carl's son-in-law, Masami. I don't know if you knew Masami Sore or not.
Yeah, I did.
But it was more him. And, like, obviously, I wouldn't mind people thinking that Carl trained me, because, like, for obvious reason. But he would, you know, he would come there.
Well, you had the Malenkos there.
Yeah, the Malenko.
Who was direct from, and not only Masami, but the Malenkos, you know, had worked exclusively with Gotch.
Yeah, and Malenko... Man, it was just, I was so blessed, Jerry. So blessed. And I didn't have any money. You know, I'm the little skinny ass kid, 15 years old. You know, he took me in, man. And I tried to do the best I could to help work it off. Like I would make the posters and the tickets and help him promote the shows and stuff like that. And I would stay in the ring, Jerry. You guys, I would stay in the ring all day. Like each person, each student would get in and practice their shit on me. So I got all the ring time, you know, and that's why my technique was sharp or whatever. But like, yeah, man, I'm so blessed with that kind of training, man. It was incredible.
And when you came out of that training, was that when Dusty was booking here and Eddie was gone, or was that after?
No, it was that Crockett had already bought Florida. And you know, when he was buying up like UWF and all that shit, and they kind of quit doing the TV, and at that point, Mike and Steve started doing some other independent shows. They were running some stuff at like the Robarts Arena in Sarasota, what was it, RC Reynolds or what was that PWF that Dusty was doing, and like. He was working with Big Steel Man on top, and
PWF,
and Gordon was doing commentary with DDP and all that. So that was going on, but you know, Malenko was like, you know, they had that falling out, him and Eddie Graham, and so like it was, you know, we were, you know, weren't part of that and that, but like a lot of Malenko's guys were working on those shows,
right.
But no one had me on their show yet. I was just a skinny little kid.
What age were you with your first match?
I was 16 when I actually had my first match. I was 15 when I started training with Larry, with Malenko. But yeah, it was just at some little recreation center, like probably a half mile from the Florida State Fairgrounds.
Yeah, and how did you end up getting down to Texas? Because you've been on TV forever. Yeah. You know, people don't realize you were 19 years old. Yeah. Here at Global Wrestling Federation with Jerry Lynn and putting on some great matches. You know, some people just assume that you're as old as me and Jerry. And you're actually not.
I just you came through there too, John.
I did.
New book. Yeah, man. That
I loved it there.
Yeah, it was amazing, right? Like it was so cool being in a sportatorium.
Yeah,
you're saying he's an old man too, then.
the real sportatorium, not the one in Florida. The real sportatorium, they're on Katy.
and that's a toss up there, John. Yeah, those are fighting words almost, and you know your record.
Hey, John. So up in Minnesota, like I had left Florida, you know, because you got so Jerry, you know, man. Florida had a ton. There was a glut of talent in Florida.
Always, yeah.
Right? A ton of that. So, and I went to Minnesota, and I stood out up there because it was all a bunch of big guys, you know, like the guys you imagine when you hear, you know, like the Eddie Sharkey crew or whatever.
Right.
But I could wrestle better than they could, you know? And so I stood out. And we had some guys like Jerry Lynn and some other guys up there that I could
tell have. Tell us a little bit about a firsthand experience from Jerry Lynn. You know, I never got to work with Jerry because he was just, you know, right after my time, as just about everybody was. But I just admired his work and his psychology in the ring. I mean, what a mentor and what a way to start your career, because you were what we called a business, married to Jerry for a long period of time.
Yeah. Well, Jerry was Brad Rangan's guy. He was trained by Brad, just like John. Yep. And I just, man, I connected with him, and we just had great chemistry right away. And we became best friends. And, you know, we came up with all these ideas and plans and, you know, and just doing stuff on our local shows there too. And we got a lot of press. You know, like it was, you know, in the dirt sheets or whatever, but just in general. And Joe Pedicino, he was starting that, you know, Global, and he was trying to do something different. And you know, he read the dirt sheets. I got the call, and it was, you know, it wasn't like I was getting rich, but man. For me, I was they put me on a downside guarantee of $300 a week, whether I worked or not. I thought I'd made it.
Big money. for somebody that didn't have any money when you started and struggled to make it. I mean, John, you defied the odds. Somebody your size is not supposed to make it in the world of professional wrestling. You defied every odd that there was on that.
Hey, so I'm going to tell you what I did. Was so Jerry, what made me want to be a wrestler was I knew somebody that worked at the Bayfront Center. So I would go to the Bayfront Center. I would help Gordon Nelson set the ring up. Start when I was 10 years old. Yeah. So I would be back around all the boys and everything. And I fell in love with it from way back then.
Well, you had great influences there, man.
Yeah. So where was I?
We're talking about Jerry Lynn.
Not to get out of order because we don't.
Yeah.
We don't follow a script.
Well, let's get out of order. I mean, we don't.
As all the old wrestlers saying, we don't follow a script. Yeah.
Hey, but that TV time, man. That GWF time slot every day after you get home from school, if you're a kid, and it's on. It's just like when Kurt Hennig told me when I got to WWF, like he's like, even if you don't like make a lot of money here, like the TV exposure is priceless. And he's right. And the same with the GWF stuff. Like that's what people knew who you were, right? Right, John?
Absolutely. Yeah. Because it was on that ESPN platform. So you got noticed nationally everywhere. So people just assumed you were a star. You know, people didn't really know the difference. A lot of people didn't. Between say the big companies and also this company that's on ESPN, because you had film it. You know, we had big crowds in the Sportatorium. Mm-hmm. Now most of them were papered tickets. You know, they'd give away tickets for free, trying to get them on parking and booze. So we'd have 2,500 people there almost every Friday night when we filmed.
Oh yeah, yeah. Hey John, I'm curious. What like I got a question for you. Which ring was harder, the Sportatorium ring or the old WWE ring? Before they got the new ones.
Wow, that's close. Because the old WWE rings, people don't realize how hard those rings were. They were.
I call it the billiards table.
Oh, my God. They were so hard. I think what happened was I'd been told, and Jerry might know this true story behind it, was when they did Saturday Night's Main Event and they saw the ring give, you know, because they had some freaking massive guys. They didn't like it. And so they tightened up the ring. And so now all the rings were freaking like concrete.
That was brutal.
The problem came was that they would but start putting in good rings with the concrete rings.
Yeah. Because John, I'm surprised you knew what ring you had. I'm surprised you knew that story, John, but that's exactly how it happened because we had the pre-Royal Rumble, you know, in one of those rings, and we saw that ring sag and those steel posts actually bending in, you know, and after that, we saw our steel ring posts, and man, if anybody ever lifted those are 200-300 pounds of solid steel. Yeah. They were actually bent in. So Dick Ebersol and Lou Del Pratt, you know, the Saturday Night Live guys, that's a set problem. We got to fix that. And that's when our rings become, immovable objects.
Hey, but the Sportatorium ring was cemented into the ground.
Yeah, it wasn't going
so
nowhere.
Hard.
And when they sold the building, they had to cut those things out of there. I wanted to go down and make a bid on those things.
You're talking about the Tampa Sportatorium, Jerry, but the Dallas Sportatorium's ring was cemented into the ground, too.
Also,
hard as a rock. Yeah. I remember when one of the crews came through, either WC, I think WCW, that's when I think Jake Roberts, somebody pulled up.
Is that when they shot?
They're going to like, we'd rather get shot than have to bump in this ring. The ring was freaking concrete.
Yeah.
You know, and the problem was when WWE first started giving good rings, you didn't know which ring you had until you got out there.
Exactly.
You couldn't plan a match because you're not going to take a bump off the mid rope if it was that old ring.
If you saw Kyoto, a little secret on that, if you saw Kyoto, you knew he was going to have the good ring.
The good one?
Mm. Yeah.
That's up to that, Jerry.
Hey, so when I came, hey, you guys, when I came back from WCW to do DX, you know, my big return or whatever, the whole negotiation, one of JR's big negotiating selling points to me was we're getting new rings. That was actually a selling point.
That was it.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, that was one of the problems because we couldn't – our guys couldn't do big bumps because
– Oh, don't tell me you would have done a bigger bump, Layfield, if there had been better rings. Come on now. I know you.
You better believe it. I might have given a bigger bump.
Yeah, John, you weren't afraid to bend a knee.
No.
You took your share.
I had no
He was old school, man. He come up in that Texas old school era there, man. He had to take a bump or they would take your ass down.
It was funny because Skandor Akbar, I rode with Ak. You know, I got to ride with Ak and Killer Tim Brooks and Murdoch and the guys.
Wow.
Such a – that was one – and James Beard, some great guys. But Ack used to always talk about Harley Race. He goes, he was the only one tough enough to bump in the keel in St. Louis.
Is it that bad in the keel?
Oh, like, man, was it ever. I can experience that. I got body slammed and a big squash by, I can't think. Maybe one of those big 450-pounder guys that they had in St. Louis. And I was about 205, 210. I've never felt it. And it, plus, Sean, it was a 22-foot or so.
You know, I was going to say, I heard it was like 25 feet or something.
Yeah, they throw you into the turnbuckles. I mean, it took a day to get there. You know, there was not a lot of crisscrossing in the matches. A lot of the stuff was done right in the center because you step out of that center, and it was like stepping on the cement. So, yeah, Harley was a badass. He was known. He was a bumper in St. Louis. So,
hey, John, you know – You brought up Akbar. Like, not enough gets said about him and what a great guy he was and so helpful to the younger guys.
He was fabulous. You know, they talk about the great managers, you know, there in Texas. I always mention Gary Hart. Akbar was every bit as part of the foundation in Texas and ever. He was one of the first guys to bench press 500 pounds back in the 50s.
Right.
Yeah, he is a big barrel-chested dude. Yeah.
I mean, he knew how to get heat, and he loved to help guys.
Yeah,
you know, he'd take you with you, and he'd start explaining to you. You know, his big thing was he never watched a match that often, at least later in his career. And then he'd come back and say, "Ack, how was it?" He goes, "Sounded great."
Yeah, yeah. That's all. Like, and it's true.
Yeah,
you could tell almost everything you need to know without even having to watch.
But we tell that story. We had Mike McGurk on, Sean, that Leroy McGurk used to do color commentary, totally blind, but he could do it by the sound of the ring. You know,
that's crazy.
And that's what you guys are saying. You know, it's Akbar. He had that Leroy McGurk training. That's where he broke in.
Yeah.
And he learned to listen to the matches like Leroy did. And you could tell what was going on.
Wow.
You know, Ack, one story that I told Sean, a lot of people didn't know was Ack, the reason he served in the Army is he grew up in Wichita Falls, and they picked on him because he was first-generation Lebanese. So he told one of the guys one day, he goes, the guy wanted to fight him. Ack goes, okay. They rode out in the country together. Ack broke both of his legs. Both of his legs. He showed me how he did it. Put it in figure four and snapped his leg. You know, he was strong as he could be.
Yeah.
And he drove the guy to the hospital. And the sheriff came and told Ack, he goes, listen, I know it was a fair fight. They want to hang you, basically. He goes, if you'll join the Army, I don't have to prosecute you. Because I know the sheriff did him a solid. And that's how Ack ended up joining the Army and came back and then started in professional wrestling.
Wow. But hey, man.
Ack was legit. He was a tough guy.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Hey, John. Jesus Christ, whose show is this? I'm asking you.
Hey, we love it. Boy, this is how what we do, Sean. We just jump in there.
It's just, man, you mentioned Tim Brooks, and I never got to be around Tim Brooks, man. And I got you would see the pictures in the magazines and a little bit on TV, but like I've gone back and watched some stuff recently on Tim Brooks, and man, he was great.
Oh, he was a great heel. I mean, a great heel. Booker T will tell you the same thing. He wrestled me and Booker T a bunch. And we wrestled one night. We had a match there on television. And, I mean, you could have drawn a 5-foot circle around us. It was a potato fest. I mean, just think of me. And when he came back, he goes, kid, we did it on television. Now we don't have to do it on every house show in the country.
Uh-huh.
And right. So he worked. And then Killer could work, but he could work snug too. But he got heat like no one I've ever seen.
Yeah. Brooks is one of those well-kept secrets, you know, that should be out there and should everybody should be talking about Killer Brooks, because John just said the secret. He was a heat-seeking missile, and he knew how to build that heat so well in a ring. I mean, that was Killer's forte, you know, was getting that heat. If you worked with him, man, you knew you were going to hear that wide heat.
Nice. Yeah, man, and like so everyone wants to work with you, right?
Yeah. Right. When Killer came to the ring, it was just a different feel. I mean, a complete different feel. The crowd felt different. People felt like somebody was going to get hurt. I mean, Killer really knew how to work a crowd and get heat. He was, I don't know, underrated, because everybody that worked with him knew how great he was. But I think underrated in history because not that many people knew him, because he never worked a major promotion, I guess.
Right. Yeah, that's what I'm going to say. Like, I seen him in Georgia and then, you know, in Texas. And honestly, that's the only place I ever saw him pop up, you know, when I was a kid.
I'd ride with him and Act and James Beard, and Killer would always love to smoke a little weed.
Yeah.
And he would never do it. He'd never do it in the car, and he never do it around us. So we'd go into like a 7-Eleven on the way to the show. Killer goes, I'm going to go around back to the bathroom. There's no bathroom back there. Killer go out smelling like weed.
Like, yeah.
Okay, guys, ready to go. But he would never do it in front of us.
Yeah. It's like, you know, I'm sure if you're listening or watching this show, you're probably, you know, old enough to know that, like, you know, it wasn't as cool. It wasn't as okay to get caught in the weed back then.
Yeah, that's right. Guys kind of kept that under wraps. Guys would drink.
Yeah.
That was pretty.
Yeah. You had to be very select on who you had as your road partner
right. Back
in those days. I mean, you didn't want it because, you know, the guys would leave in 2 weeks, you know. Hey, I rode with the Briscoes, man. And, you know, it was like they were sending smoke signals in Oklahoma.
And then the stories get blown out, and the next thing you know, yeah. It's like this big, tall tale.
Yeah. The biggest heat I ever had with Pat Patterson, you know, I love Pat Patterson. We all love Pat because he was so much in every one of our careers, you know. I mean, at WWE's existence, Pat Patterson was a part of it. But when we were coming back from West Palm Beach, Sean, and you know the road down there, you get on that Highway 60, man, there's nothing to do. You got to entertain yourself out there. It's 3:00 in the morning. Wrestlers and truckers are the only ones on the road, plus a few rattlesnakes and the alligators. So we got to go through that little town, Lake Wells, and there was little Barty fight type town, and a sheriff's deputy there that loved wrestling. So he saw Pat coming. Pat just bought him a new Lincoln Continental, so he knew I'd be a wrestler because he got figured out the schedule. And so he pulled Pat over, and the cop was just going, and Pat said, "Hey, you like the Briscoe brothers? Oh, man, the Briscoe brothers, they're my favorite ones. You know, I grew up here in Florida." Well, they're right behind me. The next car. So he let Pat go. So we're passing through this little Lake Wells. All of a sudden, these blue lights come on. We're rolling down every window in the car. We put the moon roof down. It must have looked like a damn forest fire, you know, coming up. And this cop don't get out of his car and walk to the car. He gets out of his car and sprints up there.
Oh, Jesus.
Briscoe brothers. And we're thinking, oh, man, there's Mike Rotundo in the back along with El Grand Apollo. We're all thinking, man, we're going to jail. Eddie Graham will fire every one of us. Oh, man, I've been wanting to stop you guys forever. Can I have your autograph? Sure, man. So I don't take it. Boom, we were out of town.
Fucking Pat.
Yeah. Next morning on TV, we nearly killed Patterson. You know,
Puck, we're in Florida, and I know my good friend Charles Wright, Godfather, won't mind me telling the story because I think he's told it himself many times. I would never tell anything to embarrass him or anything, but I don't think he doesn't mind. So him and Viscera are pulled over and stopped by the police. So me and Ron realize, oh, geez, man, they may have something on them. So we pull up and we're going to try to run the distraction and get them out of there. It's like 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Oh. So the when Godfather gets out, they've been enjoying the afternoon drive. Right. And so he comes out and goes, "Hey man, the police officer recognized us driving down the road, pulled over and wanted to get an autograph." So there's a drug dog in the back of the police officer's car. So when he stopped the Godfather, and Viscera, the dog is going, like, dude, let me out. And the cop says, "Oh, he's a big fan of you too. He must be
right."
And I'm like, "Guys, please go. Please go."
Hey, I've been on a trip or two in the same car with Charles and Viscera. So I know what goes on in that car.
Oh, my goodness. Me and Ron almost had to check into a secondhand smoke clinic riding with Betty and Godfather. We'd pull over at Bob Evans. We'd get like cakes and pies. They'd get chicken breasts and water.
I used to be like, "Charles, at some point, this is like wasting the weed. Like, it's too much." Oh, my God.
Hey, Bucky,
at what point is that?
One thing I always thought when I think about you today was, you know, watching some old stuff, the Freebirds. You know, I think they're probably the four greatest factions of all time. My opinion would be NWO, DX, the Four Horsemen, and the Freebirds. You know,
Yeah.
New Day might be in that talk, you know, a few years from now, but I'm going to exclude anybody today. But, you know, I think those four are pretty safe for the Mount Rushmore. I always thought Buddy Roberts was one of the most valuable players for the Freebirds.
Yeah.
Just a heat getting little son of a bitch.
Yeah.
I always thought your role was kind of the same.
It was.
They could get massive heat.
Yeah.
And you got to have that guy in your group. I mean, Buddy Roberts made the Freebirds. I always thought you helped make just as much as everybody else or more, you know, whatever you want to say, those groups, because you were that heat getting guy, like Buddy Roberts.
Well, and thank you for recognizing that, John, because that's by design. That was on purpose. I was the Buddy Roberts of the Wolfpack. The Wolfpack was like the Freebirds. We were real, like, we were, like, even we did the Freebirds rules. We called it Wolfpack rules. Like, if one, like, yeah. Scott and Kev were the tag champs. Kev was hurt, so I defended it with Scott and, you know, things like that. And, yeah, man, we were just, we were like the Freebirds. And we weren't afraid to admit it either. We were Freebird marks, regardless of whatever.
Yeah. But it's very similar. You had a guy that could talk. You had the guy that could work. You had the guy that could get heat. I mean, it was very very similar in many respects.
Yeah, Buddy Roberts is just like the unsung hero, man. And, that's who I battered myself after. I like to think I knew my role, you know, I was happy in my role. You know,
Sean, I think that's one of the reasons why you were so successful and everything you did. You understood the psychology of it. And I don't know if it was that Malenko training and those early days you had, because they taught that a lot. But you understood the role of either a babyface or a heel. You understood when you were a babyface, you were the underdog. And you understood that size difference, and there was no ego in you in size. The only ego you had was in the quality of your work to be the best. And so I think that's really, when you understand that psychology of our business, big guy, little guy, then you're going to be successful. But when you go, hey, I'm a little guy, but I'm going to be a big guy.
Oh, yeah. And I see guys doing that these days, and I understand what they're trying to do, but it's not, they're shooting themselves in the foot. You know, but I'm proud of like the way I kind of my method of having the big man, little man match. And man, I just loved it. It was my favorite thing to do. Like it hurt my body more, you know, than having a match with like somebody like, you know, another like quote unquote cruiserweight or something like that. Like I wasn't a big, like, I'd rather work with the big heavyweights. First of all, it paid more money, and I thought the matches were more compelling, and I love to sell.
Eddie Graham's philosophy with me is, you know, because Jack was heavyweight champion of the world, and back in those days, you know, you didn't dare put brother against brother, so I always bitched at Eddie, you know, I'd like to be junior heavyweight, and he said, you don't ever want to classify yourself as a junior heavyweight. Promoters will start saying you're a junior heavyweight. And then you're going to be in that role. If you want to make money, you got to work. You got to be a heavyweight.
Yeah, that's why I fought it, and not in WCW, because they did a pretty good job with their cruiserweights down there.
I did, but
it just wasn't a thing for Vince. And like when they decided to put the cruiserweight and the light heavyweight, so like I didn't want to do it. You know, I just didn't want to do it because I know where that figured in the card in WWE. That's just the way it was, you know.
Me and Ron got, you know, to work with all the great tag teams. And that was one of the greatest eras of tag team, in history. You know, not the best, but one of. We always loved working with you and Kane. And I loved it
with you guys.
Every single interview, you had the ability to make a match and understand size difference. You never once shot me or Ron off.
Never.
You know, it was such a great dynamic working with you guys because of the way that your ability to be able to work with a huge partner against two really big guys.
And I, something about me, like I really like, and maybe some guys don't as much, but I really like the physicality of it, John. And we would get physical in there, right? Like,
oh, yeah.
And dude, I'm sure I lit you up a few times. Like, I never heard anything about it from you, but like, I got into that, man.
Yeah.
I get a little bit goosebumps just thinking about it right now.
You know? And the good part was we liked working with each other. There wasn't an ego. There wasn't. The match that we dropped the titles to you, I just looked up to make
sure. In Chicago.
I just looked up to make sure I was right about this, because as you get older, you conflate matches and stories and towns and get stuff wrong. And people on the internet say, oh, that wasn't, that was here. But I remember we're talking backstage and they wanted us to slip on a banana peel. And Ron said, why would you do that? And he said, they said, what do you want to do? He goes, just have them beat me. And, you know,
because, I remember it.
Because Ron was the bigger name, it meant more to beat Ron.
Yeah.
And so they wanted, Ron said, why don't you have Pac beat me? And they said, how do you want to do it? He goes, with his finish.
Yeah.
And it was perfect. But that was Ron's call, because Ron knew he was the bigger name. He knew that him getting beat was much better, and him getting beat right in the middle of the ring was much better for you guys than it was by slipping on some banana peel and kicking out on 2 3/4.
And Kane grabbed you and grabbed your foot and pulled you out right as the finish happening, right? And it was just a simple, Ron goes for his. I slide behind him, hit him with mine. And yeah, it was perfect. But yeah, man, I love working with you guys.
Guys overthink it sometimes. It's not that hard, you know.
Dude, I remember, like, not to get too far off into weeds, but like, Ron is the most explosively powerful man I've ever been in a ring with.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, there's Mark Henry, world's strongest man, but like the explosiveness of Ron, like, and man, like, I used to love it when he would do that FU slam to that one-handed slam where when he did, man, he picked Matt Bloom up over his head with one arm like that. I couldn't believe it.
Sean, we had Lex Luger on not long ago, and Lex actually played college ball against Ron, and he said their defensive lineman their offensive lineman at Miami when they played Florida State was in fear the entire week and prayed the coaching staff and the training department trained this kid all week to try to just negate some of Ron's power.
Wow. Yeah, man.
When Barry Switzer played against the University of Florida State University, they said, hey, how are you going to beat the Seminoles? And he goes, got to figure out how to block Ron Simmons. And that was it. That was his whole game plan, was we got to figure out how to block Ron Simmons.
I never seen a pop. Like when we did TV Raw or something up there
in
Tallahassee.
Yeah.
And the place was going nuts, man. Like, it was the biggest pop of the whole night. And we had everyone there. We had all our biggest hitters on that.
Yeah. And the place went ballistic. Yeah. I've never heard a pop to this day bigger than Ron Simmons walking out in Tallahassee. Yeah. And the whole stadium was doing the tomahawk chop. I mean, it was incredible.
Yeah. There were moments like that, you know, that we remember, but that was definitely a great moment. And a great moment, Sean, when we were talking about you and Kane. One of the great moments that you taught Kane how to communicate, you opened the door to Kane to become mayor of Knox County, Tennessee. It must have been so much fun teaming with Glenn, because he's such a great man.
He was the best, like, okay, obviously DX and like all the partners like that people think of, but he was my favorite, because like we got to do some really cool stuff, like the dynamic, our relationship. And just not your typical bookend tag team, the opposite of it. Right. Like,
right.
And it was just really neat. Some of the stuff we got to do and explore. And it was the same night that John was just talking about, like right after we won the belts from them is when we had Kane talk. And that was back then, man. We like, honestly, like nothing was scripted. We kind of had an idea what I was going to say, but like, you know, I just went out there and I just kind of said whatever came to my mind. Like, I mean, it was.
And those interviews stand the test of time.
Yeah. Yeah. It's
so funny, Sean, to watch the guys now, you know, the old guys like us go back, because not to say that one generation is better than the other. You know, our generation couldn't read scripts because we never did it. This generation is not as good as ad-lib. There are some guys that can, but for the most part, they're not good. But to see a bunch of old wrestlers get scripts, they'll sit there just try to memorize it.
What's this?
We still get them confused with the drugstore scripts. That's the only kind of script the old guys have.
It's just the worst.
Oh, Jesus.
How crazy was the Attitude Era? I mean, it was it was doing stuff that was insane. And
yeah.
I was out there, and it was just carte blanche.
Just talking about the on TV, what the people on saw on TV, right?
Yeah, well, we've been saying everywhere, but it was
but,
on television.
But to, this, man, you know what segment got like a lot of people didn't like, but man, it was just so off the wall that I loved it. Was the Mark Henry like Mae Young that, giving birth to the hand? I don't know why I like that so much.
I loved it. I thought it was great. You know, guys talk about being edgy now, you know, breaking the, you know, the fourth wall,
yeah,
if you want to call it. But when you walked out as Mark Henry with Mizark in Carney,
oof,
you know, that was just like an insider joke to the boys. You know, and the guys, I see wrestling now, a lot of times they try to do some insider stuff, you know, to kind of get to the internet crowd. We were doing it back then, and I'm not sure trying to get to the hardcore crowd. It was just to pop each other.
Yeah, it was just for each other. Like, you know,
our entertainment.
I remember Lawler, but like, I got a pop out of Lawler when he saw it. So,
I remember the first time I did commentary, I go down, I sit by Jerry Lawler and JR, and JR had these copious notes. I mean, everywhere. He had note after note after note, and Lawler is drawing somebody in the front row. That's all he's got. Well, Jerry Lawler doesn't even know the show.
Jesus. But he didn't need to, right?
No. Lawler's Lawler. He's incredibly.
Hey, were you there? Like, do you know when they had that Faker Taker thing? Do you know he drew all the tattoos, all Undertaker's tattoos? On, that was crazy, man.
Yeah,
that guy's really brilliant. Talented. Unbelievable.
Yeah, they're incredible artists. Les Thatcher and I started the first T-shirt company, and we had the Briscoe Booster shirt and a T-Bulk T-shirt. So we needed artwork, and I didn't know anybody could do the artwork. Les Thatcher picked up the phone. Now, this is in 1972, 73. Called Jerry, and Jerry sent us the artwork for the first T-shirt. And I wish I still had those hardcore, you know, prints that he drew up back in those days there. But he was a talented man.
Brilliant. Just brilliant, like, in general, right? Like, to be able to be brilliant at something like that and just also be...
You know, people laugh a lot about it. It's territory there, but Memphis was one of those independent territories that you always saw a good talent go in and out to work with Lawler. Lawler was smart enough and you know, knew the business well enough to come in, you know, as a total fan was what Jerry was when he got in the business. But he knew he had a plan what he wanted to do. And he brought everybody in, and he filled that Mid-South Coliseum up all the time.
Yeah, and he could, like, he wasn't, like, your typical athlete, but, man, he was tough, Jerry. Like I remember watching him get, like, Joe the Duke throwing him, like, outside the ring onto this table on the floor. And, like, he literally, like, split his quadricep. Like, he cut, like, to the bone, like, I know people used to say they used to just tee off on him, and he would never complain about getting potato, nothing like that.
No. Yeah, that was Lawler. Lawler never complained about nothing. I mean, nothing. You know, nothing bothered him. Nothing.
He had a casket match 2 weeks ago with Enzo. He's still having matches. 2 years ago, you guys. Like, no, it's been more than 2 years ago. I had a match with him at the halftime of a Memphis Grizzlies basketball game. The ring was suspended about 150 feet above the arena floor. And I was scared shit the whole time because, like, I thought I was going to fall off the edge of the ring. Like, anyways, but we had this match, and it was just a normal Jerry Lawler match. And he still does it. It's incredible.
I think Lawler would wrestle every single weekend right now, if he could. I make fun of him, you know, for being old. He's not that much old. He would wrestle. He loves wrestling. I mean, loves it.
Yeah.
Did you ever work with him, John?
No, only on commentary. I don't think I was ever. I may have been in a 6-man tag with him at WWE, but I never worked with him in Memphis. He was already gone at that point. And
I've worked with him in a hot program in Memphis, and I've never seen anybody over in a town like that guy was over there. He worked with my brother. I helped set up the match for the NWA Heavyweight Championship. They bring a little brother in first and Lawler would go through me. So we had like a 4 or 5 week program leading up to Jack and the King. And then when they were finished, Jerry and I come back in the next week there. But he was so over. He could do no wrong there. And Jerry, his pr- promos for Memphis just fit to a T because he was one of them. He is one of them. He loves Memphis. And I think that's what made Jerry so hot there, because he was a hometown hero that made it big on TV. And he was on TV every damn Monday night at a positive thing. He must have the greatest library in the world of him beating every damn superstar.
Every big name in the business.
That was Jerry's gimmick, you know, come in and beat, you know, the Bockwinkles, the Ganyas, the Briscoes, you know.
The Road
Andre
Warriors.
The Giant. Yeah. A Road Warrior. You can go down the list. Waller has a video of him winning.
Wow. But Jerry, how bad did WWE get him back? He finally gets to WWE, and he gets his WrestleMania match against Michael Cole.
Yeah. That was beautiful.
Hey, Jerry came to Florida, though. He didn't go leave Memphis much, but, like, I seen him in Hawaii a couple times. But, like, he came in Florida. I was watching this match about a month ago. It was him and Mike Graham from the Armory. It might have been the Armory or the Bayfront Center. Him and Mike Graham were a team. And the people are going ape shit for him, Jerry. Like, he was over, like, wherever he went.
It was over. It was over. Jerry would miss, you know, like a lot of other guys. Florida was the vacation spot, of course. And guys from all around the country, if you came into Florida, Eddie would book you and he'd grab a shot in Florida. And Jerry would come down once a year, and he would get over on our TV. Yeah. We always had a little method, you know, send 2 or 3 weeks of TV in. Boom, and Eddie would put him right in the middle of the card, and the people bought him every time he came down. He was a star.
You know, TV Guide had a deal a few years ago. They said top 25 moments in television history, and one of them was Jerry Lawler and Andy Kaufman on The Tonight Show.
Still, yeah.
I mean, Jerry was, you know, people now, they know he's funny. They know he's, you know, he's the modern day, you know, version of Bobby Heenan. But people don't realize how he was a massive star.
Yeah, and just like Jesus, I just had a huge brain fart.
But the whole thing with Andy Kaufman, I mean, that was made because of Jerry. You know, Andy Kaufman was extremely talented, don't get me wrong, but that was the whole thing was made because you had the perfect baby face to go with this little bitty whiny heel.
And New York passed on that, right? Vince Sr. passed on that.
That's doing the story, that? Yeah. Yeah. And apparently it wasn't gonna happen. And Letterman was going to go to commercial, and Kaufman called the ad lib and did the whole thing. And it was taped. It wasn't live. So Letterman had the option of not showing it later. And they didn't think they would show it. And then they showed the whole thing unedited. They just bleeped out all of Kaufman's language, and it became this biggest angle in wrestling.
And I wonder why Letterman got so upset if he had that right, because he refused after that to have any type of wrestler on, right?
That's well, right, yeah. Like, I know he had Killer Kowalski on one time, but that might have been before the Lawler thing.
When they did the remake movie with Jim Carrey, they had extra security there when they did Lawler's scene. Like he's gonna go crazy and start beating up the camera person.
Like Jerry says that, like Jim Carrey was really, really wacky to deal with at that time. Like he was like getting really like immersed in the Andy Kaufman, you know, persona or whatever.
You know, Jerry, he had to, from what Jerry said, he had to be picked up in like an Andy Kaufman, like whatever car he drove. Yeah, he was a real method actor. Wow. Whatever.
Hey, Jerry. Hey, Jerry. Hey, man, we were just talking about cruiserweight, light heavyweight, junior heavyweight stuff. Right. Like, and, you know, trying not to get, you know, like pigeonholed into that. But, man, one of the greatest pro wrestling matches I ever seen was from the Bayfront with you and Danny Hodge. Man, did you ever see that, John?
I haven't, no.
Oh, my God.
I'd love to see it. I'll get it, and I'll put it on your playlist on our YouTube channel, and I'll watch it today.
Oh. I tell you what, what's the introduction of it? I mean, I'm standing there, you know. I would know Danny Hodge, but, you know, Gordon Solie, as only Gordon Solie can do. Ladies and gentlemen, in this corner of whatever champion I was, you know, blah, 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 All-American Oklahoma State, blah, 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 Jerry Briscoe. And in this corner, two-time Olympian, three-time national champion, two-time outstanding wrestler, the holder of the record of the most falls, the fastest falls. I mean, you know, 15 minutes of introduction. I'm saying, holy shit, what am I doing here?
Wow.
But Hans gave me a match, and it was a simple finish, you know, airplane spin, and I got did it, and he rode through, you know.
But like from the get-go, like just you guys just trade going back and forth. It honestly looked like you were really testing each other out in there.
Well, I tell you something about Hod, and I, you know, a lot of people laugh about this, but you know, we went to, because they're not showing the match in entirety. I worked with Danny one time up in Savannah, Georgia, and I actually think he had flashbacks because he went to the University of Oklahoma, and I went to Oklahoma State University. I think he would have flashbacks, and Jack told me the same thing, that sometime you just had to reach down and give Danny the old office, you know.
Office.
Danny was working, you know, losing up. And that's how that entire match was at the Bayfront Center. And I think that's the reason it was pretty decent. You know?
Oh, yeah.
Legend has it that Hanson and Brody had a safe word for Hodge. I think it was Bluebird. That if Hodge got in there and was tying one of them up, the other one had to would yell out. I think it was Bluebird.
Come and make the save.
One, the other one come piling in. So when freaking Brody and Hanson have to make a safe word for a guy.
Yeah, right.
Wow. That guy's a badass.
That's respect right there. That's for sure.
Sean, when did you when you got to WWE? Did they have the whole thing planned out for you and Razor with the 1-2-3 kid from the beginning, or did it form after you came?
No. Well, I mean, it came after my tryout. You know, like right. But, maybe about 3 weeks after my tryout, Vince called me. Just long enough to where I was wondering if I was ever going to get the call. And then Vince called me, and he ran the whole thing by me, you guys. Like, and Pat was on the line, too. And, like, just how it all played out, that's how he laid it out for me. Like, it was – and I had to go do Super Junior Tournament, New Japan. I still had that commitment. So after I got the big win – then I was gone, and like, so we had 6 weeks in between. So that was the only part that was a little different than how he laid it out to me, because the rematch didn't happen for several more weeks, but it made it better, like him taunt me for an extra, you know, extra few weeks. So yeah, man, that was all. And it was not just to introduce me, you guys, it was to turn Scott babyface. It was to turn Razor babyface, and it worked. Two birds with one stone.
Wow. Yeah. What a terrific! That was one of the best storylines WWE ever. Everybody remembers that.
Yeah, everybody still talks about it today.
It's the great. It's like I can't think of a better way to be introduced, because like 99.9% of talent that gets introduced come in, get some vignettes, get some squash matches, you know, and. Man, the way
did you go to Japan?
It was a brand new show at that time too. Yeah. So I mean, it helped build the show, and it helped build you guys.
Yeah.
Did you go to Japan after the you did the squash job for Scott, or after you went over with the moonsault?
Well, I did the squat. Like, okay, so I had a match with Matt Bourne as Doink, where he just ran through me. Then one with Curtis Hughes. I might have the order mixed up, but it was two basically, you know, squash matches. So people like had 2 weeks where they see me get my ass beat.
And then you went to Japan and came back and did that.
No. Then like I come back the next week, I have the match with Scott. I get the big win. It was on the tape. It was on a tape show. Was it the tape? Yeah. And that's when I left. I left right after that.
Right. Yeah. Cause that's when I saw you. That's when I was with you in Japan.
No.
Was it or was it not?
No. I was a couple years later, because Vince actually – I asked Vince if I could go to Japan for Tenryu, because I missed Japan. Right. And so he lent me to Tenryu.
And I just started to work for Tenryu. Yoko was there. That's when Jericho was there too, right? It was in the junior heavyweight tournament.
Yep.
I remember seeing Jericho there and thinking, if this young guy can live – he's going to be good. Those guys, the junior heavyweights then, the guys you were with, they were unbelievable what they did.
Yeah. Yeah, man, I had a hard time keeping up when I went over there for that one. Oof. I'm not afraid to admit it.
So you had what were your friends saying to you when you did like the two squash matches back to back? I mean, was it hard to hold it in that, by the way, in a week from now, when this airs, your view of me is going to change dramatically?
I got to be honest with you. I don't know if I really did that great of a job of holding it in. I don't remember, but it wouldn't surprise me if I couldn't keep it under wraps.
I don't know how you could. That was such a big deal.
Yeah.
You had to share it.
Yeah. Wow. So, but I don't know. That was the most important moment of my career. Like nothing else even comes close. And there's been some important moments, but that was that set the tone for everything. So,
So what was happening with, cause we're in the dressing room back then. I came in 95 and we've talked about this. We had Phineas Godwin on, a month ago. We talked about the division in the dressing room. People said there was so much heat between the Click and the BSK. There wasn't any heat.
None at all.
There was, guys got along great. That's revisionist history from people on the outside talking about.
Yeah. It was those little things those other offshoots, the BSK, like it was kind of like it wasn't a joke, but it was, it wasn't like, oh, we're, these are our colors and, whatever. No, we all got along great. Shit. I mean, Dennis is right. Like there was no heat with any of us.
I remember because people ask me all the time, say, oh, how much heat was there in the red? There
zero.
There wasn't any. we weren't making any money at that time just because business was so bad. Neither was WCW. But that there was no heat between the boys.
Right. Yeah. No, I don't like.
What was the now during that time were you also talking with Scott and Kevin about jumping to WCW? I mean, did you have that guys? Were you in on the planning?
I was the one that got the ball rolling. Actually, John, I told the story, but I'll give you a Cliff Notes version. I was out here in LA. I was kind of recouping from injury. I was training with Frankie Pettit, with Francois.
Yes.
Because Francois was a great martial artist. And so I was training out here with him and doing some conditioning stuff and staying with Rich Menzer.
The old gym guy.
Yeah. And so Rich looked me up with Barry Bloom to meet with Barry about doing some movies. But then when I got to Barry's office, he told me about WCW and we had a little rump, none of us had ever thought about leaving, but man, when you start hearing about that kind of money, John, and less days and all that, man, it's hard not to take that serious. So I called Scott right away. It just seemed like the thing to do. I hate to say it, but, and it was the right thing to do at the time for us.
Yeah, we weren't on guarantees.
No.
The downside guarantee that people talk about all the time, 10 matches a year at $150 a year, but
and business was way down, so nobody was making any money at that time either. So that's what another thing you had to consider was actually what you were making and we were in serious trouble at that point.
Yeah. Yeah, it was hard, man. John, you probably remember if we did a certain parts of Canada or Florida was tough at the time. Like when we do a Florida run, man, if you didn't get your draw, right? You might not get that in your check.
Yeah. And sometimes you get a $200 draw and you'd owe them $50.
$50. Wow. Yeah. Yeah. Literally you're not just making that up because you've gotten a check like that before. And I have
absolutely too. Several times. Yeah. When you're running smaller markets or territories that weren't doing that well, you'd dread it because you take a $200 draw and you'd owe them $50. You'd owe $50 back. Now, a lot of times you got paid for 10 straight shows. So, you never had to write them a check or anything. Right. It wouldn't be.
Jake Roberts showed me a check one time and I thought Jake was making big money. I wasn't really involved at that time, and Jake showed me a check where he actually owed the office $750, and you gotta be kidding me. I couldn't believe how it worked, but that's how it was.
It was amazing during that time. I mean, you had you and Kane there. It's just you were the 1-2-3 kid. He was Isaac Yankum. You had Scott, you had Kevin, you had Triple H, you had Stone Cold. Yeah, he had everybody there.
Yeah,
it was just not
all the ingredients.
You had all the ingredients. Yeah. It was amazing that he didn't have that. That's, that could be in the greatest roster of all time.
Yeah.
And we weren't selling any tickets.
We didn't like, sell the pot the right way. We weren't selling the pot the right way.
Yeah. I didn't like our show. I mean, I was grateful to be there and I loved that, but like, I wasn't a fan of our product at the time, to be honest with you.
So when you went down to, when you finally ended up jumping with Scott and Kevin, what did you think when you got down there? I mean, you left WWE, you went down there, and then all of a sudden we've got this war coming. What did you think?
Hey, so, you know, I was used to the way things are done. Like, you know, you can say whatever you want about WWE at the time, but they were always organized, you know, and like you knew where you were going, like you knew what was going on. Like, that was the thing. Things were great down there in a lot of ways, but it was very disorganized. But like, honestly, you got like, that was a good thing in a way, because like you could get, like, they couldn't stop you from getting over. Like they, like it was, you know, it was just like free reign, like just go out there and do what you wanted.
And that was the best thing for your career. Cause you went from being a 1-2-3 kid, who's kind of this underdog who's fighting underneath, to being this edgy smart ass.
Yeah.
You're terrific at, because you're a smart guy and able to have that banter that you can actually get your own heat.
Yeah. But man, it was so big, you guys. Like just that whole, like, you know, like the way that NWO thing blew up and then me, and then all of a sudden being a part of it. And I was like, wow. Cause you know, like, okay, I got to be the 1-2-3 kid. And like, that gave me more notoriety than I'd ever had. But this was like, times 10. It was crazy. Yeah.
Did you guys think at that time, because we had a bunch of people on here, you know, we were all part of that Monday Night War. I didn't know. I thought Vince would probably win, but I wasn't sure. Did you guys think, when you guys down there, you're making a ton of money, you guys are killing it in the ratings, did you guys think that WCW would come out on top at that time?
Not like, okay, they're going to put they're not going to put Vince out. Like I never once thought for a second that, okay, we're going to drive Vince out of business. Like, and it was anything that I wanted to happen. You know, like I honestly thought that at some point I was going to be back, which obviously happened, you know? So
were a lot of the guys in the locker room thinking we're going to end up on top of this war.
Yeah.
That maybe had not worked in WWE or whatever. We're drinking the Kool-Aid.
Yeah. Yeah, and I understand why, because it was like a juggernaut, right? Like, and then it's week after week after week of, you know, winning in the ratings or whatever. Like,
and a lot of times it wasn't close either. I mean, you guys were blowing us away, so you guys had the talent down there, and you know. But I liken it to you know, you guys were a TV company, and Vince at that time was still a wrestling company, you know, and he focused on that wrestling and started building the stars, you know, like he's capable of doing, you know. And it was a blessing, because the winners of it all was the fans, because that competition between the two, I mean, both products got so much better during that time, but the fans won that battle.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Damn it. I had a point I was going to make. Man, I'm getting old.
Join the club.
yeah, exactly. Join the club. We'll all soon be hunting Easter eggs we just hit. But until then, we're going to have a good time. So during that time, that's when you got fired by FedEx, right? And then you were deciding whether to go back. Were you really deciding, thinking about going back to WCW?
No.
Or WWE, was WWE pretty much the only option you were thinking at the time?
Well, okay, pretty much. But, so when the negotiations started happening, like, WWE leaked the offer they sent me, and they really lowballed the shit out of me on the offer and put it out there in public, and it was the only thing that almost made me say, fuck you, I'm going back. Because, like, there was a certain amount of money that, like, I wasn't going to go for any less. And I ended up going for a little bit less than that number that I put in my head, but I got some other perks in lieu of that they probably wish they hadn't given me, because I got them to give, like, okay, 180 days a year, but you can only work me 15 days a month. So you can't run me into the ground. And like, and then I like, you know, then I told all my friends that's what I got. And then they wanted it too. So, so like, anyways, yeah. But the truth is, John, like, Paul called me and like laid that whole, like, you know, hey, Sean's going to be out. And like, you know, we want to keep DX going. And man, I just knew regardless that I didn't want to not be a part of that because I knew it was going to blow up. I really did. You know, especially if I, was coming in with some of that NWO clout still attached.
Did you have any worry about it? Because I mean, like, it's like trying to replace Animal or Hulk. You know, they tried that a couple times. It didn't.
Yeah.
You know, it's like replacing any great team. You know, you're taking out Shawn Michaels because of injuries. He was going to be gone. Yeah. Even though he was around a little bit, he was gone. And trying to put something in that place, did you have any hesitation? Like, this might not work.
No, because the thing is we didn't put someone in his place. I came in to my own place. I didn't try to become what Sean was for DX.
Right.
I was just me. And you know, I never once thought of it like that. You know, like I never felt like I was trying to fill anybody's shoes. It was just like, you know, even if Sean was still there, that would have been a spot for me if I was coming back. It just was natural, right?
Right.
Because of all of our relationships.
Yeah. And Sean and Hunter, I mean, they became massive stars pretty much on their own. I mean, they just started doing all this. They were as entertaining as two people had been. And Billy and Road Dogg, I mean, those guys were, I mean, they were below mid-card, I guess you would say, or mid-card. I don't know if they that's not fair. About where I was.
Yeah, but they were getting traction, right? And they like the people were starting to get with them. And it was perfect. It was and we all just gelled once we all got together. Once I had a great relationship with Brian anyways, prior to that. And Billy too, like Billy and Bart and I, like we started at the same time for Vince, you know, and we worked a ton with each other, you know, when they were the guns and stuff like that. And just, man, it all just felt so right. You know, and like everything, like so much of that stuff that happened organically, you know, is like, I think just what, you know, what really cemented us with
I remember, you know, the night I was there the night that Road Dogg and Billy started tagging up, and, you know, they weren't really being used by anybody. They'd been tried a different, you know, couple different characters, couple different iterations.
Rockabilly, like, you know, the real Jesse James. Yeah.
Road Dogg is just as entertaining.
Roadie and all that stuff.
As any human being alive, he really went out there with an open mic and they just didn't care. They go, just say whatever you want. And he went out there and he was the Road Dogg that we saw in the back and people went nuts over him. And then they became, you know, one of the biggest tag teams of all time through that entire thing.
Hey, but
John, like, John, yeah. it's amazing. John, I think hit on a point there, you know, a guy's personality in the back, a lot of times, you know, their personality in the ring is completely opposite. But when they're able to do what Road Dogg and some of the you guys did, bring that personality and put it in the ring, that becomes them. That is them. That's who you're seeing. And that's the reason they're so entertaining in the back, you know, because once they make that projection and they tie the two together. But Road Dogg, I mean, everybody was around him backstage. So when he went out, everybody listened to him.
It's weird. It's funny you say that too, because like this, his brother Brad was like that. He was a character in the back, but he couldn't bring it to the in front of the camera part, right? Like Brad, one of the greatest, right?
Yeah, and he was. Like, he was to me the greatest. Yeah,
yeah, and that, but like, I don't know, man. Sometimes we get out there in front of the camera, and it's just really hard to be 100% authentic,
right?
You know, like it's weird, like. Yeah.
Well, I think part of it is, you know, when we broke in, you had a certain mindset of being a wrestler.
Yeah.
And, you know, the funny stuff in the back rarely ever translated to what was in front. You know, a guy like Murdoch would do some crazy stuff, but he was different. You know, most of the guys were just, they were wild and crazy in the back, but they always had a certain stick. You know, it was always this brother. And the Attitude Era allowed guys to be themselves, for the first time. And when guys that made it because they were able to figure out how to take that camera down and just be themselves, which the guys we saw in the back were just people don't realize during Attitude Era, the dressing room was just as entertaining as the show.
Oh, yeah.
We had some funny guys there. Stuff, the hijinks that would go on, the banter was, I mean, it was world class.
Yeah, like that era, like when I think of that, and I think it, you know, every time I see you and Jerry, like on a tweet or something, doing the show, like it brings me back to the time I'm in a dressing room, and all of a sudden I hear this screaming, but it's like not just screaming, it's laughing too, like it's like this agony and also like can't stop laughing. And I turn the corner and there's this stack of gym mats stacked up. And Jerry's got you. It looks like he's got you like an abdominal stretch, like all just stretched out on here. And you can't help. Like you got snot coming out of your nose. You're laughing and you're crying. And it was just, it's ingrained in my head forever. Every time I think of you two guys.
That's where you came up with that stupid phrase, tap like you mean it.
Come on, John, tap like you beat it.
The night before, I won't tell the whole story, but the day before I jumped Jerry and I got him pinned up against the fence and I wouldn't let him up.
He bag jumped me, Sean. Remember, Sawyer Brown was playing the pre-show in Greensboro, and I was walking out to the ring while everybody's watching rehearsal, and a sucker texted me and bag jumped me.
Yeah, and I got him.
I would have to back jump you too.
I got him stuck down by the fence, and I won't let him up. And Sawyer Brown quits doing their performance and goes, "Sorry, guys, we got to stop. Looks like somebody's getting their ass whooped." Jerry was so mad. The next day, he sends out for shoes and shorts, and he wants to meet me in the ring. I said, "Hell no, I ain't meeting you in the ring. You got to work on this one." So he calls me into an office. It's him and Pat. And Jerry's sitting right across from me. And Jerry, I realize in hindsight, he takes off his glasses. He takes off his watch. And he's
chewing me out. Oh, he does the take off the watch gimmick, huh?
Yeah. And he's chewing me out. He goes, "John, you can't have horseplay like that. You know, I'm an old shooter. You got to have respect." Finally, I said, "Jerry, I'm just fooling around." And I don't look my head. And when I did, he bum rushed me. That's why I ended up by those mats.
he was on one of those folded chairs, and he was rocking back and forth. And I said, "Man, if I time this just right, I can take his ass."
And I had my feet stuck and in the chair.
It just right, just as he was going back, man, I got him.
Oh, it was great.
And so Jerry's got me, and I realize I'm about to be choked unconscious. And he goes, "You better tap, you Texas pussy." So I go, "Okay, Jerry, okay." And I went, just like that, little tap. He goes, "No, you gotta tap like you mean it."
But that's how it was. We just had a ball backstage. We worked our ass off so much, you know. I mean, you had to have some little relief backstage, and we had a group of guys who knew that and contributed to it. So it wasn't all work.
Hey, Jerry, you were mentioning that you had Pete Gass on, last week or recently. Yeah. And, like that's still one of the greatest segments ever. Like you probably talked about it at length, but man, you know, obviously it was one of the highest rated segments ever, if not the, but like just the people just ate it up, man. I felt so happy for you guys, you and Pat out there. Man, I got goosebumps thinking about that too.
It was fun. And Pete told us, Sean, you know, what a valuable mentor you was to him, man, and that you took him aside and gave him a lot of advice during that run, which he said I needed so much. And to have a guy like Sean Waltman, X-Fi, come up to me and tell me what I'm doing wrong and tell me some suggestions really meant the world to him. I want you to know that.
So. But like, I'd like to be like that anyway, just because like people told like were like that with me. But also, like he's involved in my stuff. Like he's in my program, like he's with Shane, and like he's involved in my matches. So it behooves me to smarten him up, right? Like that's how like a lot of guys have gotten smartened up over the years, was they end up working with someone great, and like that guy has to smarten them up so they don't fucking make him. Oh, excuse my language. Don't make him look bad.
Yeah, and then that's one of the things that the Main Street Posse fit right in with everybody. Right. You know, they came in that had no background of going through the territories. The guys all loved them.
And they were real humble.
They were good guys.
They're real humble. And I remember being concerned that maybe there might be some resentment. And like I didn't want them to, like I want them to feel welcome, honestly. Like I like those guys. And they brought like they brought something to the table.
They did. They certainly did. They were undersold faction at that time, and Shane needed them, and I think they helped Shane's growth to what he became by being a part of that.
Oh yeah, and they really helped dress up that match that I had with Shane at WrestleMania 15, and you and Pat too.
That was so much fun.
I hope I didn't potato the shit out of you, Jared, because
I hope you did.
And I loved it.
Oh, but when I look back at it, I'm going, oh my God, it looks like I just killed Pat and Jerry. It was right on my entrance. They came out
which time? That was the thing that I loved. Pat didn't like so well, but you know, you guys did treat us like we were 55 and 56. Everybody was striving to get over. You know, I gotta understand. Everybody wanted to get over. So we were looked at it when you looked across the ring, we were just two more guys you had to go through, and you weren't going to work with us any different, you know, than you was anybody else. Mine, the bumps might all not been there, but as far as laying it in and making it believable, man, everybody brought it. And that's what got Pat and I over, because we took all that crap. You know?
Yeah. Wow.
You know, one thing, Sean, that I've told many, many times on many interviews was when you would hit a guy in the corner, chop a guy, and then do that spin kick.
Yeah.
And I've always compared it to other guys who would throw reckless kicks. You know, the worst thing in the world is when you come off the ropes and somebody has to put up, you know, your hands like this because you have no idea where they're going to hit you. You know, liable to break your nose, your eye. You always would hit it right here on the jaw. You know, sometimes a little snug, most of the time not. But you never had to put up your hands. And there's a real art to that, to be able to do that and not have to have a guy, you know, just throw up his hands because you're so reckless.
I, you know, that's one of the reasons why I used the corner for that, John, is it's like a bullseye. It's like a like having a sight, like, and being able to aim. Like if I was just standing in the middle of the ring, I could still hit it. And I've done it a bunch of times. But like there was something about being in the corner that helped me. That helped me, you know, get that kick right in the right spot. And I very, very rarely ever missed that. Like when I started missing it here and there, I quit doing it.
Right. It makes such a difference to not have to put up your hands and be worried about, you know, getting your head knocked off.
And John, those were the things that like helped me. Those were my equalizers in there with guys like you. Cause like I did have some offense you could sell.
Right. You know, the other thing we had kind of in common was when Ron was getting ready to retire, I turned heel on Ron.
Yeah.
You know, I never had a match when we didn't want to have a match. You know, we said we don't want to end up in an angle, period. When we're done, we're just done. But Ron did me he created JBL, you know, because of the association I have with Ron. You do the same thing for Triple H. You know, when he turned heel on you, you realized it only made sense him turning heel if he did it on you.
Oh yeah. That I'm glad you brought that up, you know, cause that goes along with the Shane match from WrestleMania 15. Because months before that, Vince brought me in and like sat me down and asked me if I would have that match with Shane at WrestleMania. And I was honored. Like at first I was kind of like, oh, I want to have a match with like somebody that's been wrestling a while. Like, you know, but then like immediately it dawned on me, look, this is really good for me. But like my thing was to Vince at the time was, yeah, but I'm going over. Like, and he's like, that's fine. And I'm like, and I get to like Shane, I call the shots. Shane has to and he's like, that's fine. And but the more we were getting down to the match, like, and Paul's telling me, I'm turning heel, and like it just dawned on me, like if he doesn't turn heel on me and screw me, his heel turn ain't going to mean hardly shit. Or it's not going to mean shit. It's just like, how can we get the most out of this? And it was good for me too, man, because it martyred the hell out of me. You know, like that was what led to me and Kane having that great run. So, you know, it was good for me too, but that needed to happen for Paul's turn.
Right. That's a lot of people make that mistake sometimes. You know, you got to do what deep down makes people go, ah, come on. That wasn't good.
Yeah.
Not just always turning heel. It's like, ah, that's not right. You know, and once you have a friendship like that, invariably that friendship gets broken and somebody turns heel.
Yeah. Yeah. So no, it was great for me. Yeah.
I don't know. You know, I don't watch a ton of the stuff that's not WWE. There's so much wrestling on TV today, you know, that it's hard to keep up with WWE, NXT, and, you know, and every once in a while I go in and do some commentary. Is there any comparison now between the war of the late 1990s that we were in with modern wrestling, with WWE and AEW, you think?
I mean, I can see some parallels, but I mean, geez, just like, it's so much like the whole atmosphere, like the playing field is so much different.
Right.
And like, just the, the numbers, like what we considered, you know, like the numbers they get now that they consider good numbers, we would be like horrified. Right.
Right.
Like, I mean, we were, yeah.
We'd think we're losing our job.
Yeah, like under 2 million views, we'd be like, oh my God, you know, end of the world. And now, like, that's a good number. But I think they're, I'm waiting to see. It's really like an interesting time, like, to be like, to just sit back and watch what's going on. And I don't know. I think it might be. I don't know, John. What do you think?
I don't know, because it was such a unique time. You know, the numbers were different, but TV's different. So it's not fair to compare ratings, you know, from now to the, you know, 20 years ago, because TV was so different. At that time, we had a head-to-head live show that was pretty much a zero-sum game. You know, somebody was going to win, somebody was going to lose.
Yep.
There's never been anything like that. That's like another NFL league starting up and saying, hey, we're going to go against you guys on Monday night. And by the way, that's our only show. And one of us is going to go out of business. I mean, that, I don't think there's ever going to be anything like that again, as far as that part of it.
Right.
Now, as far as the attrition to survival, I could see some type of parallel, but not as far as, I mean, that was a huge stakes game being played at that time.
Hey, John, do you remember like there being this much tribalism in the fan bases like back then, like WCW, WWE? Like, I don't know if I mean, obviously it was there and like people had their favorites, but like, man, it's just gotten so bad. Like how toxic like the people have gotten over that.
Yeah, you know? I don't know if it's because fans have such a voice, and maybe it's a smaller minority than what we think, and they're just more vocal than. Because they're able to be on your phone.
Yeah.
You pick up your Twitter and it comes from a bunch of people. Well, maybe it's 10 people that have 50 followers. You don't know. Uh-huh. You don't know if that represents a broader. But no, I didn't think the tribalism was that bad back then. You know,
I didn't either. I've never seen so much passion nowadays with the fans that they have. They actually have more passion, I think, than the talent do, you know, towards the product there. And that's the big difference I know. And I think it's a very toxic atmosphere out there. And I didn't feel that at all. I mean, we all hated WCW. I mean, get right down to it. You know, I made a statement. If I'd seen Eric Bischoff, I wouldn't have wanted to kick his ass, you know, after what type of job he did, you know, getting that way. But, you know, nowadays, I don't feel that way toward anybody else, but there was some heat, but it wasn't toxic like it is now.
And you know what was, if there was some toxicity within the fan base, like the one where I noticed it really, not between WWE, WWF fans and WCW fans, but WCW fans versus NWO fans, all in the building, like, the WCW and NWO fans had a big like riot with each other in Canton, Ohio one time, hooligans in a soccer stadium.
Yeah. Like a European soccer match there. But what I see now too, and I hear a lot of it, that the fans realized that they were the benefactor of that war there. And so I think they take a lot of pride because they saw the business just ballooned to unreachable heights at that time. And the talent was just, man, look at the talent that was on both sides during that time.
Yeah, so I think, like, it would be, I wish people would just be grateful for all the great wrestling that's out there now, man.
I do too,
like, going at each other.
Because back then, when you have like NWO versus WCW, it's kind of like the NASCAR fans. You know, they show up wearing their 34, their sevens, their right. threes and stuff, and they'll bark at the other fans of so-and-so, but they're all fans of NASCAR.
Yeah.
They're just fans of different drivers. You know, I felt like that's what it was more back then. Right. You know, now it's
good analogy.
Now it's different, but you know, our rosters were pretty much split with you guys going down to WCW and us staying. We'd all work together. I mean, all the guys have been in territories together, you know, and then all of a sudden now we're at war with each other, but it wasn't like the boys had a lot of animosity toward each other. We had animosity toward the company itself, the hierarchy and all that stuff. Yeah. The boys didn't.
Yeah. And like, I, you know, when we invaded the Nitro that time, you know, the DX right. thing.
Yeah.
Like, I wondered, like, because we never thought about, hey, if any of the boys were going to be pissed, right? Like, any of their roster. Because, you know, we were friends with, like, so many of them guys. But, like, I come to find out maybe there was a little bit of resentment, like, with some of the guys. Like, and I guess I can understand that maybe. Like, how would you feel, like, if WCW, like, showed up, you know?
Well, we had an example of it, Sean, when ECW showed up and everybody was stupid and didn't inform the town of what was going on in the back. I mean, that could have been a serious, serious night.
Yeah, that was going to be a fight.
That's crazy.
They didn't smarten up the boys in the back until after ECW had already made their presence known. The boys were coming out, and they were coming out to fight.
Yeah, and there were some guys in that ECW roster that you probably don't want to mess with.
Yeah, yeah.
It would have been a fight.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Bob, and all. Yeah, there's a couple of them, you know, that you knew you'd have to break.
Yeah, Jesus.
You know, I love the fact, you know, that night that you guys invaded WCW,
the Scope in Virginia.
Yeah,
yeah. So afterwards, Jerry came around and told me and Ron, said, "Hey, would you hang around in the back in the parking lot because we don't know if WCW is coming over to invade us." So we hung around, I looked around, Jerry had told the Blues Brothers and Shamrock and Blackman and stuff. And we're sitting out there thinking, you know, if Haku shows up, we're going to send out Shamrock and we're going to get the history of the world. They may be fighting 10 years
from now. Right?
And hope the cameras are rolling.
But what an incredible time, because, you know, we didn't know either. You know, we didn't know what was going to happen. You know, guys were invading each other's live show, and it was a pretty cool time.
Yeah, man. Yeah.
I love the fact that you guys had a backup plan. I think it was Sean Selman had an extra video.
Yeah, that was my biggest concern was not if we were going to get arrested, but like how if shit goes down, how do we get the tape, the video? You know, keep it in our custody, you know, because I mean, there would be all for nothing if we didn't have that.
Right.
That was such an incredible time for you guys to do that, because it was just something you guys did. I mean, and yeah. it was planned. It was, everything was, you know, obviously you're
not planned that well. I mean, it was a half baked plan, man.
I loved, I saw an interview you did, and I didn't realize it was the time when you guys were in New York one time shooting fireworks and stuff. That was just because the tape show had a 10-minute yes. short, and they told you guys just go do something.
Yeah, and we just walked out to New York City and just acted like fools. Anyway,
when I got the name, or you started using the name Wrestling God, it was because of the same thing. We were backstage. And they said, "Hey, well, John, we need something to celebrate. We need to kill about 4 or 5 minutes. We're gonna send a camera crew back here, celebrate your win." So I got Doug Basham there, and he's going, "You're a god." I go, "Yeah, I'm a god. He goes, "You're a wrestling god." I go, "I'm a wrestling god." That's how it came about. But back then, stuff just happened because we were told we need 4 or 5 minutes.
Yeah. John, you brought up a wonderful time we used to have there in between shows. Sometimes we need to kill some time, and we had nothing that, you know, we didn't want to stick a match out there for 3 or 4 minutes. So, hey, John, or hey, Sean, go out and entertain the folks. It's basically what we told everybody to do. Just go out and entertain the folks. And some of the funniest stuff I remember Hunter one time was out there for like 5 minutes. He'd say, and he was working the microphone, like the microphone was cutting out on him. He did a whole damn routine like that. And the people were hilarious when it came back.
Oh, I used to get told all the time, John, we need 10 minutes. Just go do something. I go, okay, send Taker out in about 10 minutes to chokeslam me. And so I just sit out there and I just do one thing after another. I try to get Taker to break character. I try to get all this stuff. And the end of it, of course, is choke slam, tombstone, all this stuff. Okay, now we got 10 minutes. Let's go on with the show.
Don, man, that JBL thing was one of the greatest heel characters ever. Dude, I'm just telling you. And just to watch like the growth from you know, doing just the APA stuff to then, and like just your work as a great in-ring singles guy, dude, that was incredible, man.
I had so much fun, but I had the best talent in the world to work with. You know, I had so many great guys that I was able to work with. It became so easy. You know, Eddie was the right guy. Taker, Booker, you know, all those guys that I had, then Cena at the very end. I mean, it was just, I had all the right guys to be able to make this heel character.
Hey, Cena talks about something with you, like, it was a recent interview he did. You know, you familiar with that?
I saw some clips of it, yeah.
Yeah, I guess it was that you dropped the belt to him?
That's right, yeah, I dropped his first.
And apparently there was something that you said to him, like in that conversation, that he learned a lot from.
Yeah. You know, I think it was me trying to explain to him, look, I'm trying to become the biggest heel in the world because I want to give you the biggest obstacle in the world to overcome, because this is all about you. You know, and that was really my only concern at WrestleMania, was I want to make sure and do my part to make him, because that was my job, you know, because guys did that for me. And it wasn't like I was passing the torch. You know, Cena was going to be the guy anyway. I don't want to take any credit for anything he's done. But that was my role at the time, was to make sure and be the biggest heel I could so that I could make him. And I remember kind of the conversation of explaining to him, look, this is why I'm doing this. This is why we're going this way with me, because this is all about you.
Yeah, man, you set the table for him.
Yeah, and I never dreamed he'd be a 16-time world champion doing all these movies. And, you know, he's a wonderful person, a human being. I think the world of John. He's so respectful. He's so nice. I mean, he's the right guy.
Yeah. I mean, I just remember when it kind of seemed like he was, I don't know if you remember, he used to come to TVs and he would do dark matches and stuff most of the time when we were out in California. Man, I don't know. It seemed like they kind of knew he was going to be the guy one day. Like I remember Pat looking at him, and I just remember, like, at least it seemed like to me this guy was going to be a big star one day. You know,
yeah, I think they knew right away.
So Sean, we went out. Me and Bruce Pritchard. You remember? You know Rick Bassman. Rick Bassman called me and he said, "I got a couple of people out there, and Victoria was out there. He had a roster of really good talent." So I knew Rick from here in Florida. And so I called Bruce and JR, and I told him, hey, this guy out there, he's training somebody. He said he got somebody really special out here. So me and Bruce were sent out to watch Rick's show. We saw him. He was so good and so impressive that we thought it was a one-off type thing. We really did. Yeah. And so 2 weeks later, Bruce went back out there and saw him again, and he was identical. Then Bruce and JR went out. So he was very well scouted. And when we signed him, we just had that feel about the guy. I mean, look who he opened up with. We wouldn't have thrown him out there against Kurt Angle if this guy wasn't going to be something, you know. But boy, did he fill those shoes.
Sure did.
Yeah, and, you know, it's a big difference in a guy going an 8-minute match and a guy going a 30-minute match. You know, you guys understand that. You know, 8-minute match is easy. You get out there, you're shine the baby face, you get heat, you go home. 30-minute match, you got to take people on a roller coaster. Right. And I remember being out there, I think Cena had done some with Angle first, who's obviously Kurt's one of the greatest of all time. And then he did it with me. And I just remember his feel for the business. It was really unusual, because when you first take a guy in that 30 minutes, it's kind of, you get in the deep water and you can feel him kind of reaching, you know, just trying to, you know, make sure that he had a feel that was unbelievable. And I remember telling Vince, going, this guy is really good. And then saying he's not just a bodybuilder. I said, nope. I said, he's your guy. And I never dreamed that he would be the guy that he became, but I knew he was the guy that had the talent at the time, at least, to carry that role. And of course, then he goes on and becomes one of the greatest of all time, which
and he was called the prototype back then. And that was a good name for him.
It really was.
He was so freaking big and so strong. He's almost world class strength, as far as his Olympic lifting. Well, Pac, I want to tell you, me and Jerry have been looking forward to having you on, and this has been a treat for us.
Yeah, a great time.
We miss being in car rides and being in bars and talking to guys, and now we do it over Zoom, drinking non-alcoholic beverages. But that's okay.
What a switch!
You've always been one of my favorites. One of my favorites to work with. You're one of my human beings on the planet. And I can't thank you enough. You're one of the greatest workers I've ever worked with. And I've worked for a long time.
Hey, that means a lot, man. Like, respect from our peers, man. That
right.
I mean, obviously from the fans too, but man, there's just something about, when you hear that from your colleague, man, it means the world. And I feel the same way about you, man.
Yeah, Sean, we've been around a long time, man, and all through the years, I don't think there was ever a time where we disrespected each other or didn't trust each other. And I'm so proud of your growth, man. I've watched you become who you are. I've seen you at your lowest point, and I've talked to you, and I've seen you at your highest point. But I think right now in life, you seem to be at the greatest amazing place that you've ever been, man. And I'm so proud of you, man. And what are you up to? I mean, what's going on in your life?
I just do my show, Pro Wrestling for Life.
Okay, great.
I do these on Tuesday. So yesterday I was doing my
it's a great show. I watched some of them today getting ready for the interview. It's a great show.
It's got some different segments, some fun segments and stuff,
And forgive me for not promoting Pro Wrestling for Life in the intro.
Don't worry. But Jerry, don't worry, man. Jerry, I just, you're saying that you saw me at my lowest too, man. And yeah, I remember the time when I broke my neck and you were at the hospital with me. Because, we weren't sure. No one was sure whether I just OD'd or something in the ring or what happened.
Right.
I remember you telling me, I almost had to fire you, but you broke your neck, but it was a broken neck. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, Jerry, you have seen me at my worst. And you always don't, regardless, man, you always treat me like $1 million, man. And I just love you to death, Jerry. I'm honored to be able to call you a friend, both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.